That's why he has the channel Dedunking. So he goes around debunking debunkers. And he's a pretty feisty guy. I wouldn't want to get in a fight with him. But he brings an intense energy about, let's get down to real brass tacks and let's see what's going on. So that's one thing I really appreciate about Dan. And from here, you can take it over. Oh, by the way, Dan's a former electrician, and his work with electricity, well, it'll be in a video. I have a video coming up that we shot just before the event, and I put two of my electrician friends together, Dan and Kevin Petrilli, at the Modern Megalithic Lodge, is what I'm calling it. And it has a lot to do with electricity, so that's why I'm bringing that up, but you'll have to wait to see the video to see what it means. It was a lot of fun, yeah.
Okay.
Thank you. So how's everybody doing out there? I hope you can hear me all right. All right. Sedona is a really beautiful town. I like it a lot. It's a lot different than Spokane. You guys have probably seen this before. This skull was found on the border between Mexico and Arizona. This is local. And I'm sure you've seen these shapes before. If Derek didn't clue you into these things, I'm sure Brian Forrester has. But these are the elongated skulls. Now, you get a lot of, as a skeptic, I look at it and immediately I look at the counter-arguments. And the counter-arguments of a guy like Brian Forrester saying that this is another species or something to that effect, they always come down to sagittal sutures and other disagreements. The cranial capacity may or may not be larger, depending on who you ask. The eyes may or may not have been larger, depending on who you ask. And it's very frustrating for a guy like me, because I just want to know. I don't really have a dog in the fight as much as I just want to know. And that's where things get really frustrating, because while we've got thousands of these things on the record, or at least hundreds in museums around the world, the cover-up around them, again, a skeptic, when I found that there was a cover-up, I don't like to use that term lightly. I don't like to just say, you know, they're hiding things from us. That's an easy way to support any idea you want, right? And I found the cover-up so much, so heavily in real time. This is in my home state of Washington. This is in Longview, where it was. This is gone now. This was known as Coffin Rock, and the Native Americans up there, the Chinook tribe, when Lewis and Clark came to that area, there was 3,000 burials like this, where they would take a canoe and elevate it, place it in an area that predators couldn't get to, and just kind of cover them up and lay them down. All 3,000 of those had elongated skulls, artificially modified craniums. And when I say elongated, I don't mean just a little bit, but they don't quite look like Peru. This is one of the ones that we have in the record that we still can get information from. You won't find it on Google. You're going to have to dig deep. And that cover-up is the very beginning of it. For example, I don't know how many of you have studied the elongated skulls, but I know that most of you here probably weren't aware that there was more of them in Washington than there was in Peru as far as what we have in the written record. But we don't talk about that. People that live in Washington, Derek lives in Washington. He's pretty into the skulls, and he's telling me I blew his mind with telling him that basically two stone throws away from where he lives, they were doing this. But it was so ubiquitous that all the Native Americans on one side of the Cascades, all of them on the east side, it was a sign of freedom. It was a sign of you were a free person. If they kept slaves and they had a bit of a caste system, and if you were lowborn, you weren't allowed to modify your children's skulls. But if you were a highborn person, this is what your skull would look like. It was actually an insult. What, did your mom not have time to shape your skull? It was a little crazy. And so then the cover-up started a long time ago. This is Memaloose Island, and Memaloose is the Chinook word for death. You can see there's some white guys there that have decided to dig up everything they could on that island, and eventually one dude got, they found him staked to the place, the natives had it, but they were looting this stuff wholesale, and it was such a big thing. But here's one of the things you'll notice in this photo is that skull that you see in this image is quite a bit larger than the other skulls that are around it, that black skull in the center. If I go back to the one before, it's over to the right side, and you can see that it's quite a bit larger than the other skulls in the picture. Not enough larger that it's going to make it to giantskulls.com, which is why it's still in the University of Oregon's archives. I mean, they looted this stuff like it was nothing. And these skulls, again, these were all, it's hard to tell in a lot of these images, but if you look very close, you can see that they're all misshapen. This was something, again, if you didn't do this, you didn't love your kid or you were lowborn. And then people ask, well, where are all these in the record today? Why do we have none of these? And this brings me back to what I was saying about the discussion about sagittal sutures and orbital size of your eyes and cranial capacity. This stuff has been hidden from us. And, you know, if, for example, if, I don't know how many of you are aware, but, you know, silver quarters. I bought this from Coin Heaven out there, right? It's a quarter from 1963. And back in those days, they were 90% silver. Well, it's not like that now. Now it's all just, you know, crappier metals. But if you went to a bank and said, I want to buy 1,000 rolls of quarters, how many silver quarters do you honestly think you'd come out of it with if you went through? And probably none, because for the last 50 years, people have been selling them for $14 instead of 25 cents. Good deal, by the way. But the fact that this is called selection bias. This is something you could say, in a lot of cases, we know something existed, but we also know that it's really hard to find. Now, much harder to find than it ever, you could have ever convinced anybody that was using it contemporarily. Excuse me. This is one of the Chinook skulls. This is, again, very hard images to find. This is from a Smithsonian book called The Chinook Sign of Freedom. And this was in 1960, excuse the marijuana resin on there. And this is from 1960, and you can't get it anymore. It's out of print. They don't even store it in their archives. Now, if you look at the skull, here we can see it's very well documented, right? This is, and it's quite a lot like the ones we see in Peru, but not quite. It's similar, but not quite as exaggerated. And they did quite a bit of work on this. It's only about a 30-page pamphlet. But one of the most interesting things, and this is why it's important, again, to that we don't have the things that we should have in the record. Look at the top of this skull where we always talk about the sagittal suture, and this is from the unknown Chinook chief. So it's just some Indian that they dug up who had an elongated skull. They call him a chief, sell him for more money. But the next one is from the famous Chief Concomly, which when Lewis and Clark published their journals, there was two Native Americans that were extremely famous, Sacajawea and Concomly. Concomly was over on the coast, and he had this elongated skull. He was blind in one eye. He was extremely smart. He was such a friend to the Europeans. He would tell the other Native Americans, like a couple of times they got really angry, we're going to go kill all the white people. And he's like, hey, man, do you see how tightly woven their cloth is? Do you see how ugly and savage their weapons are? Do you see any of their women or children? You don't want to mess with these guys now, because when they start bringing their families in here, they'll just wipe us the fuck out. He's a pretty smart guy for in the early 1800s. Notice he has a sagittal suture, and it's not fused. Now, if you're not aware, the sagittal suture normally fuses at around 28 to 32 years of age on average. So there's a lot of variables here. We know Concomly lived to the age of 63. We don't know the age of the unknown Chinook chief. Concomly, by the way, 3 years, didn't matter how much of a friend he was to the white man, 3 years after he died, they chopped his head off, and the Indians hid it. They took him out of the canoe and buried him in a coffin, and they found him, dug him up, chopped his head off on that island I showed you earlier, and they sent it over, and it was in the museum in Cambridge for, I think, about 100 years before they repatriated, 80 years. But next to each other, you can see the difference in sutures between these two Native American skulls that lived pretty close in time to each other. And this is why, just one example of what we're missing in the record. When we talk about these things, Does the sagittal suture not close at such an early age, or such a, at the age of 28 to 32? Clearly not in the case of Kong Kong. He was 63. Well, we don't know the age of the other guy, and both of these skulls now have been repatriated, and this is, understandably, the Native Americans are covering this because, again, they went and chopped off the skulls, and so you get... We might be really nice, and they might be thinking, man, you guys are pretty politically correct nowadays and pretty empathetic towards this, but your kids might not be. So we're just going to keep this skull where we hide it. We know where it is, and fuck you, you don't get to know anymore. I can't blame them for that. So when they no longer have these things available because out of cultural sensitivity is the excuse. And if you saw me on the panel a couple nights ago, you know, I kind of call bullshit on this because it's ubiquitous. It's everywhere, all across the world, pretty much. The museums are like, oh, we're trying to be culturally sensitive, so we're not going to display these skulls. We're not going to put them out. We're not even going to show you the measurements. We won't even show you a photograph. And, you know, this is for that to be a ubiquitous practice across the world, there's no way that all the tribes feel that way. And so really great to meet Derek. I was here at the event, and it's great because he lives really nearby, and as I said, he was completely unaware that these skulls are in the record and right next door to him. Sammy Lee is Mike Collins of Wild Wolf Productions, is his producer. She went to college at the University of Oregon and studied Native American history from the region for 2 years and had never once heard this. Again, the Native Americans west of the Cascades called the ones, excuse me, east of the Cascades called the ones west of the Cascades flatheads because they all did it. They all had some way of modifying their skull in a tribalish sort of way. It was all a little different, but it almost always had that bulb shape. Now, the looting of these things became a literal family pastime. So again, you can't really blame the Native Americans for not telling us where it is, or whether the ones that have been repatriated are. Because here again is Coffin Rock. Now this is in Longview, Washington, and this was what was covered with 3,000 different burials with artificially modified skulls on it. Now you can't really see it there in the bottom right-hand corner. There's a little bump there. After the story about Coffin Rock is hilarious. It had those 3,000 skulls on it, 3,000 burials with people with elongated skulls on it, and Lewis and Clark's day. But just about 10 years later, Lieutenant Charles Wilk came through on this big expedition around the world for the United States. And when he got up into that area, he went to the top of the hill. He did some astronomical observations. And then him and his boys left, and their campfire accidentally burnt the place and destroyed all the burials that were there. And no, there's been no skulls spoken of since then. Now, the locals say that the place was partially modified. Think Ganong Padang. It was basalt columns and laid out in a way that was potentially partially modified. On the one side, it's a little difficult to see in the older photos, but they started mining it. And as you can see there, they destroyed most of it. And in that picture, there's a spire on the top left. That was all that was left of it. They mined it for basalt, which is incredibly crazy because the entire area is just a basalt, and they did it for gravel. But it was the Native Americans, it was the place where it was like their sacred lands to be reborn, right? They picked specific areas and they considered them very sacred, and it was part of their afterlife. You couldn't just bury somebody anywhere, you had to bury them in the right place. So when R.A. Long moved into that area, who was a Freemason, and it was Robert Long, R.A. Long. He built the place into, he stole a lot of their, how do you put it? He stole a lot of their, the gravel from that, stole their mojo, basically. He took the gravel from that, and this is the city of Longview, and it's laid out in the form of a pyramid. Those four lines that come out were all paved with the gravel that came from Mount Coffin. And there's a lot to unpack as far as that goes, but the fact of the matter is, even if you don't believe in the magical ability of being reborn with a certain rock or whatever, being at a certain place, R.A. Long certainly seems to have. And the destruction of that site. Nobody could buy it. They wouldn't let go of it until it was completely destroyed. And even now, there's a concrete company that owns it, and you can't go put your fingers there. And if you remember yesterday, Derek spoke about the elongated skulls, and he keeps hammering at something that I'd noticed as well. You see those, you look for big rocks. Somewhere nearby, somebody's raising megaliths. But up in the Pacific Northwest, we don't see that. And this is part of the reason why. These guys modified this? Oh, we'll get rid of that. Now, this is what's called the Bridge of the Gods. It's a bridge that is clearly made by man, but, excuse me, it's based on a bridge that the Native Americans recorded crossing the Columbia River, and their description of it is a rock bridge that had a mystical fire in the center and a beautiful woman that guarded it, and a long tunnel that was really dangerous and scary to travel through and was the only way down to Columbia. Now, geologists say this was just a rock slide, and there was certainly a rock slide in the area. There's no question about that, but the geologists say this was just a rock slide. This was the bridge. But this doesn't explain the woman with the fire, and it certainly doesn't explain this long, dark tunnel. They tried to make it just like a little overhang. Some people even said lava tubes, it's an avalanche of rock. So did you keep one big piece with the lava tube intact? You know, they're looking for any way they can to explain this away. So the Bridge of the Gods, we don't know for certain about, and there's our Chief Con Conley I spoke about a minute ago. There's one depiction of him that's an artistic representation that shows him with an elongated skull. You'll notice here they just hid that. And that representation was done like 2 years ago on Instagram. If you go through the area, even at the rest stops, it'll show a picture of Con Conley talking to Lewis and Clark, and it looks like a scene from Gunsmoke, even though it was drawn like in the 2020 or something. The cover-up is really ridiculous, to be honest with you. And there's a reason for this. I don't know if any of you guys who know who Nelson Rockefeller is, but he was into elongated skulls. Now, he was born too late for the mad dash in the Pacific Northwest, where thousands of them were just laying around for the taking, and the Freemasons were burning places where they were at, and the Indians were too sick to do anything about it. He's born too late for all that. So when he found out that there were skulls in Paracas, Peru, well, you see what Google says is, really quickly, for those of you who like to use AI to do your research, you see how I've got it on all there, and here's the AI overview, and it says that there's no direct mainstream archaeological connection between Nelson Rockefeller and the Paracas elongated skulls. But then you click on the AI mode, and it's like, oh, his connection to the skulls stems from his extensive support for Peruvian archaeology and personal. Don't trust AI. But Nelson Rockefeller found out. Getting ahead of myself here. Nelson Rockefeller found out that there were skulls in Paracas, Peru in 37, and as you can see there, he abruptly decided to take a three-month tour of South America. And that was because the museum director, Tello, well, you can see right off the bat the fuckery that's involved here. You look at the very last thing. What is the correct total, 429 or 451? That's how many bundles that they pulled out of these grave bundles that have the elongated skulls. So one of these numbers could facilitate stealing. If it was 429, well, you know, you could have gotten rid of a few of those and sold them. Of course, the number that they actually go with is 429, and they claim it's just a clerical error. But then when Rockefeller goes down there, he spent $3,000 because, well, Tello wanted more, but Rockefeller offered him $3,000 if, and this is so Rockefeller, it was only a quarter of amount, but you know, if you give me four or five of those bundles that you got there, buddy, let me come and cherry pick four or five of those bundles. And so that's exactly what he did. And out of 400 and some odd of those bundles, he got to pick four or five. Now, Tello, before this, was working off of $300 a year to keep his entire mess open. So this is 10 times what his yearly budget is. So of course he let Rockefeller walk away with those skulls. Those skulls were displayed in the National History Museum in New York City. They were displayed in the Met. And there's newspaper articles that talk about it. There's no photographs. There's no measurements recorded. And they were repatriated. But Peru, they don't know which ones those are. They just put them on the shelf. I don't know. My skeptical side of me says they probably never left New York City. Rockefeller sold it to one of his other buddies, claimed it was repatriated because, to circle back where I started, we don't know what we don't know. We know. I guarantee you that Rockefeller, if one of those skulls was just screaming alien with big old horns hanging out and a third eye in the center, do you think he left that one? He didn't keep that one. I'll just take this one over here. Oh, hell no. He's going to take the very best ones, and then we can't find them in the record. So as a guy who's skeptical but wants to know, when I can't find the best examples, I go back to this quarter. If they're in the record and people are talking about it, but I can't find it, and then guys like Rockefeller were involved looking for it, all of a sudden it's like, okay, selection bias is playing a heavy role here. We don't know how... arguing, in my mind, a lot of it is the discussion about the cranial capacity and stuff is almost moot because the ones that are going to have the craziest ones, we know we don't have them. We can guarantee that. And I'm sorry, I won't make you guys read anymore. I'll start going back to images. I'm a Beavis and Butthead fan, and I'm the same school of thought. I don't want to sit here and read. I want to look at pictures. So here's a picture that'll show you some of the fuckery we were looking at here. This is from a paper that is from 2019. And you can see this is a distribution of elongated skulls around the world. And I'll give you a second to look at that. And you can see that the Pacific Islands are pretty much completely empty. You can see that the middle of the United States, there's not very much there. There's just this tiny little arrow. But you can see that it's a pretty coastal thing. Now, there's a book that was published in 1938. I'm not really good at Spanish, but this is the book here. It's a hard one to find a physical copy of without paying some money. But in it, this was the map of elongated skull distribution. So from 1938 to 2019, we lose knowledge. We lose the eastern seaboard of the United States. We lose the middle of the United States. We lose the Pacific. We lose chunks of Asia. I mean, I was always taught that science like gains knowledge as we go forward. But compare the two maps. Almost 100 years passes. It's peer-reviewed published paper. And if you don't know what peer-reviewed means, that means that a bunch of these other guys got together and said, yes, you did your shit right. Good job. Might not agree with what your end results are, but we definitely agree with how you got to them. So they passed this knowing... to my mind, there's really no question at that point. They are erasing the things from us in real time. This skull was found in China. It's about 10,000 years old. There was a few skulls found alongside it, and they were mistaken for about 30 years for being Cro-Magnon, which isn't, you know, entirely crazy. But then I want you to look again at the skull of one of those Chinook natives. Not identical, but very similar. And this is Cro-Magnon. Again, not identical, but very similar. You can see why the mistake was made. And the question about why people would artificially modify their kids' skulls, I mean, you know, one of the contemporary reports of the people that saw it in the Pacific Northwest said that the child in the binding looked like a mouse with its eyes caught in a trap. They were bulging out. And they said it was hideously hilarious. So you can imagine a parent doing that to their kid. There's got to be some reason. Why the hell is it all over the world? Well, if they were mistaken by the experts for a different species of hominid, it's, in my mind, a pretty safe place to start anyway, that maybe they were trying to emulate these other species of hominid. So then at that point, you get to... looking at these other practices of smashing the skulls. And we get the Stewie Griffin. You've probably seen these kinds of skulls before. They tend to look along. It didn't show up. They have these things. This kind of a flattened out skull. There we go. Homo habilis. And, you know, so when we see those skulls that are modified, that are made to look like another flat and wide, it's not a safe bet, but it's a good possibility that these are done to emulate another species of hominid. Which then brings us to these guys, because all of a sudden, you're not going to find one in the record. Neanderthal had a bit of a pokey thing in the back, and then nothing like this. So that's where the skeptic in me has to kind of defer to guys like Derek and say, all right, buddy, I'll step back and let you talk about this one now, because they could be trying to emulate another species that's from outer space. And I don't say something like that lightly, and it's not something I personally believe, but it's something that I feel that is it's being rejected without a cynicism instead of skepticism. As I've just gone through and shown you, it seems pretty obvious to me that they were trying to emulate something. And we don't know for sure what they were trying to emulate, and we probably never will. I mean, this is another great example. I promised I wouldn't make you read again, and I lied, sorry. Ask my exes, I'm notorious for that. But in this case, this is all the way in 1979. He opened, the director of the Paracas site opened 54 of the mummy bundles, and he recorded what was in six, and he put the other 48 back on the shelf, and he didn't even identify them by number. So, guy needs some more funding for his museum. He walks to bundle number one. That skull's not gonna sell. Walks to bundle, this skull will sell, and he writes down those six. Well, we got six ones. They were missing the skull, but we got some good ones here. It was the mishandling of these things has been so consistent that you really it becomes again very difficult for me to not be skeptical of the people involved more, and knowing again, to bring it back to the quarters, you could buy 10,000 rolls of quarters today, and you're still probably not going to find one of these little guys, because it's been so heavily searched. And this, you could apply this same thinking even to just step off the skulls entirely for a second. You could apply the same thinking to those vases that Ben Van Kirkwijk likes to talk about. When Max Fomachev recently did his takedown of it, he went to the Cairo Museum and he measured what they had there, and he says, these are not nearly as nice as the one in Matt Bell's collection. And at the end of the day, he's not taking any of the selection bias into account, as far as I'm concerned. The fact is, we know that the Cairo Museum has been a little loose with their artifacts over the last couple hundred years. We know that Sir Flinders Petrie was talking about precision stone vases over 100 years ago, so there was people in the know and people not. And talk about an Egyptian artifact that doesn't look Egyptian, it looked like damn flower pots, man. So it's the kind of thing, if the measurements weren't taken super accurately, which none of them really were up until recently, easy thing to swap out one hard stone vase for another and throw $50 to the guy that's letting you do it. At the end of the day, when we have reports of precision stone vases, and then we can't find them in the museums, but we do find them in private hands, selection bias seems to be, in my mind, far more of a likely thing that happened, as opposed to just they never existed to begin with. And this, again, brings us back to the way that these skulls have been disregarded. Or, you know, we live in these times where people, they pick and choose their scientists even over whether or not they're in alignment with them, let alone their politicians. We got to the point where you could have two scientists look at the same skull, and one will tell you that the DNA says X, the other one will tell you the DNA says Y, one will tell you that the eyes were this big, the other will tell you the eyes were that big, and we've all seen this happen in the last 10 years, and it's gotten so bad with things like this that, honestly, without the proper evidence out there, without the proper data, I don't see how we could even make anything except for musings and guesswork. But that's, again, when we go back to the megalithic structures. There is potential signs of those up in Washington State. They're just hidden more. By the time Washington was being settled, there was laws, nothing like NAGPRA, but there was laws against just completely destroying the Native American stuff. Not all of Washington, but by the time areas like Longview, getting a little bit inland, Portland, Seattle, all that stuff, by the time when it was getting off the ground, there was laws against doing what they did in St. Louis, for example, just destroying all the giant mounds. So if any of you work construction, I'll explain to you how NAGPRA works from a blue-collar perspective. Now, from a white-collar perspective, if you don't know what NAGPRA is, it's Native American Graze Protection and Repatriation Act. From a white-collar perspective, it says if you're digging in the ground and you find any Native American artifact, you turn it into the local museum, and they come out and they evaluate the site to see if it's a grave site. And if it's a grave site, well, we've got to talk about what we're doing here. So from a blue-collar perspective, what happens is you find an arrowhead in the ground, you tell your foreman, he tells you to shut the fuck up, put it in your pocket, and you carry on digging. And so, again, we have this polarized problem where we're not getting the information that we need. And so, to circle back to Longview, by the time that people got to the Pacific Northwest and were settling it heavily, they did the same thing. They shut the fuck up and put it in their pocket. They destroyed the Native American sites. They raised them to the ground, literally, and didn't let anybody come and look. The Daughters of the American Revolution tried to buy Mount Coffin. They were turned down. Sorry, you can't do that. We need the gravel. Any of you who have ever been on Randall Carlson's tour up near Spokane, you know that all of the hills in Washington State are covered in loose basalt that's fallen off. It's telling me you need basalt gravel in that area is like saying I need to mine some red rock here in Sedona. I mean, this area is special for having red rock. It's like, there's some right there. Right, come on, man. For gravel? I mean, we're not talking to build something. We're talking gravel. And how good does it have to be? So ultimately, when they like to put us in the same camp as flat earthers. Put any speculation at all. They like to label it all conspiracy theorist woo. As many of you that I've talked, had the pleasure to talk to personally at this event, have heard me say now, we live in it. They've done this well. They've done the PSYOPs so well that the federal government can release the Epstein letters, and most people are like, oh, that's just that crazy tinfoil hat bullshit. It's like, dude, how much? When they've got you browbeat that hard, buddy, they can do whatever they want now, can't they? To quote Carl Sagan, if you're not allowed to question those in authority, if you're not allowed to be skeptical of them, then you're up for grabs. And we live in those times where if you're skeptical of archaeology, which, I mean, let's be clear, being skeptical of carbon dating is one thing. Being skeptical of the story that a dude made up attached to the carbon dating is something else entirely different, right? A historian has the sense to know that their story isn't science. But an archaeologist, for some reason, think, oh, we wrote this story, and it is hard science. And give you one example of this. It's not about the skulls before I end it here and start taking questions or let you all get out of here. This bone is way over in France. It's 35,000 years old. It's from Aubry Blanchard is the place. And I don't know if you guys saw the headlines not too terribly long ago, but where this thing right here was supposed to have been the new proto-writing, in the beginning of proto-writing. This was found in Germany, very close, the same culture, the ordination culture, found very close to the bone in Aubry Blanchard that I just showed you. Now, they said that the tech marks on this, you know, the hash marks, it could well be, you know, Grok owed Frank 17 spear points or whatever. They look like tally marks, right? But they say, oh, the way these are arranged, and they ran it through their computer, and proto-writing's gone back by thousands and thousands and thousands of years. All right, so here's what, if you stay at Aubry Blanchard and watch the moon rise and set, this is what the moon does. This was a stone that doesn't incorporate hash marks saying that I ate three bowls today or whatever. This is a stone that incorporates hard data. Here's lunar data from the sky. Somebody sat there, I mean, just come on, let's be clear. The lady was probably just didn't want to get pregnant, so she's just watching the moon and blacking it up. But she got it figured out. And so here we go. But this is, so when science, this has been pretty much accepted since the 70s. And it was revised a bit in the 90s. But this proto-writing just got pushed back to 35,000. No, we've been doing this already. This is much better than the hash mark crap that we've been fed. But they don't, for whatever reason, things like this just don't seem to make the record. One of the things you'll notice a lot with the archaeoastronomy is that the archaeologists don't seem to accept it. They don't seem to look into it. And even something like this, some of them will accept it, some of them will get into it. It's more accepted than most archaeoastronomy. But it's still, I mean, this is the odds against it. You don't need no computer algorithm to suss these hash marks like you do on this other thing. I mean, which one of these looks like the better candidate for proto rat? I mean, come on. But the one makes headlines, and the other one just, you know where I heard about this thing first? Dr. Martin Sweatman, who's the Göbekli Tepe Pillar 43 guy. He's Graham Hancock's pseudoscientist buddy, despite being a real scientist. So anyway, to circle back to the beginning, what we have basically is a situation where, you know, I find the cover-up of this stuff to be so blatant and so obvious that all we can really do at this point, all we can really do at this point is ask why. I mean, for those of you who have heard of the kelp highway hypothesis, which is basically the peopling of the Americas, instead of them taking the Bering Land Bridge, they jumped through boats from Asia all the way down. This is why they settled all of the west coast of the Americas so quickly. That's a more modern hypothesis, but just look at this map. Doesn't it scream? Either one of these maps screams seafarers, especially when you take into account the Pacific Islands that they don't want to talk about anymore. So this isn't, I mean, if you look at this, if this was the distribution of, you know, a certain language or a distribution of a certain crop or a distribution of a certain animal, everybody would be like, oh, they traveled around the ocean and stuff. Distribution of different, nothing to see here, boys. You can get on Google, as I showed you earlier, the AI can mess with you. You can get on Google and ask for information about certain elongated skulls and it will just steer you right back to Paracas. No. You ain't talking about any of those guys. You're talking about Paracas. We know you. It's divert all the attention to these ones, and since these ones attract the ancient aliens types, now they've put us all in the you're all nut jobs category, and then we don't get to talk about things like this, which in my opinion, it's not as interesting as the cranial capacity or the sagittal sutures or where the spine connects, but this is... It's a pretty damn big appendix in my mind. It really needs to be stapled onto that because when you're discussing those things, when you know you don't know. Anyway, I think I babbled about that enough now. Thank you so much. I really appreciate everybody. Yeah, absolutely. Sorry. Yeah, if you guys want to line up over here and ask questions, I'll at least pretend to answer them like I know what I'm talking about.
Hello. I definitely appreciate your skepticism, and maybe we can just have a little bit of fun, imaginative hypotheticals. I'd love to hear your personal opinions and others that you've heard. If it's not some inspiration from another outer space beings or something like that, what do you think it might be? What was the inspiration that it could have been to go that route?
The Paracas ones, I assume you mean the really crazy ones. You know, in all honesty, you could even have, you know, it takes one Einstein, it takes one Copernicus, it takes one Newton. So you can imagine, I mean, I can imagine any way of a world 20,000 years ago where one mutant McNugget was born just looking goofy as fuck, really smart, and people are like, okay, and that just sticks. I mean, I that could be wrong, but that seems like a viable possibility to me, so.
Are there any others that people talk about?
Yeah, generally the aliens is a really high one on the list. And in all honesty, you know, I mean, again, I'm not an ancient aliens guy myself, but every time that I grab that and look at it, I try to make sure I don't do any throwing out of babies with the bathwater. And again, man, you know, you look at Neanderthal skulls and they're a little pointy in the back, but if you remember, I almost put the image in, but it's kind of, it's so grotesque, actually. There's this image from about 100 years ago. It's actual photograph of a child who's had its head bound, and man, it is, it's horrible. It's horrific, man. It's the stuff of nightmares. And that still wasn't give you what we see at Paracas on the big ones. So, you know, if I can't answer the question, I'm not going to tell somebody else that their answer is bullshit.
Great, thank you.
No, thank you. I appreciate it, man.
Hi, Dan.
Hi.
I have two questions for you. Maybe we'll do the fun one first.
Okay.
What do you think about crystal skulls that are found in Mexico and other places? And how would you kind of extrapolate with the emulation of head binding? Or were these, you know, the anatomy of a human that was that had crystallized, or is this something that was handmade? I'd love to know your opinion about that.
Well, honestly, I know that some of them they claim are hoaxes. I can't say they are hoaxes because I don't. Again, like I said earlier, the scientists at this point are so polarized; it becomes difficult to trust. I know that some of them seem to not be hoaxes, but they seem to be. I honestly think that they were works of art.
Can you talk a little louder?
Oh, I'm sorry. I honestly think they were works of art. I think that they were definitely trying to emulate. I mean, the shape of them does show that they were trying to emulate something else. Now, again, I lean towards other species of hominid usually when I think about what they would be emulating, because what do the doctors say? If you hear hoofbeats, you think horse, not zebra, right? But at the same time, sometimes there's a zebra, man. So the crystal skulls, I'm not a big fan of the idea of them encoding data, like some people say that they could encode it in the quartz. I'm too familiar with electricity to buy into that. But I am not. They're definitely an amazing work of art, and the ones that the skeptics haven't been able to kick the tires on hard enough to make it where they can say this is a bunch of crap, those ones are pretty enigmatic, and there's a reason they're going to sell for a lot of damn money, because that ain't going to be easy to make with hand tools, especially hand tools, right? Back in those days.
Okay. Second question. So the first image you had on the screen was a elongated skull that was found in the dirt in Onaves, Sonora, Mexico. And the reason I know about that image is because my research of 20 years of doing field research in the Chihuahuan Desert was about the giants in Copper Canyon and the certain baskets that were found in Sisuguichi and also in Nica, Chihuahua, Mexico. And these giants, so I guess I want to talk to you about that elongated head. They were excavating a cemetery in Onaves, and that's where they found not only humans, but these elongated skulls. I think there were 27 of these non-human-looking, right, skulls in that area. So I didn't know if I was excited when I first saw that, and I was wondering if your research has taken you into Mexico, whether it be in the state of Sonora or the state of Chihuahua, maybe researching about some of these giants and maybe some of these skulls.
I haven't a lot. Me and Derek were talking a little bit about some of this last night and this morning, and it's. But kind of like you probably got the impression during my presentation. Once I found the cover up, the individual sites and the data surrounding the site mattered a whole lot less to me than can I even access the data at that site. Here we are again,
yeah.
And that's so. I'm very interested in looking into that. He was showing me earlier today this guy who's running around Peru finding some absolutely amazing skulls just right there for the taking, basically.
Yeah.
To go to the giants, I don't know if you saw what I was talking on the with the panel a couple nights ago, but
I did. I was here.
Okay, thank you. They really blame, they really have some BS arguments for dismissing that. You get some guys that are just brilliant scientists, well known, and then they'll be like, yeah, that guy didn't know that you stand on your tippy toes or your skull gets crushed, it's going to change. So
right.
That's one of the, The cover-up on that seems to be all incorporated together. It seems like the cover-up surrounding these 6 foot seven, 7 foot tall mm-hmm. people with and the elongated skulls. And, you know, if you were to look at it just from the United States perspective, it would be easy to say, well, you know, I mean, it was a pretty racist country 200 years ago. I mean, if you look at Dighton Rock, which was found on the East Coast, it has clearly Native American glyphs carved into it, but they didn't believe that the Indian, dumb Indian can't carve rock with his arrowhead weapons. It's like, oh my God, but this was, so you could explain that away with racism if you were trying to look at it from just the States. But when you look at, you go to the island of Niue, you go to Australia, Papua New Guinea, Japan, you're gonna find the same thing. Yeah, we've got those skulls, but what letters are next to your name? And you have to go to this museum, and no, you can't take yeah. pictures, and no, you can't dress, so.
Yeah, yeah. And thank you. I learned a lot about Washington. I had no idea about that. Was that called a Copper Mountain?
That was Mount Coffin is probably
okay.
the best way to
that
find it.
That was fascinating.
From Longview, Washington.
Yeah,
thank
amazing.
You.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Hi, Dan. Thank you so much for the presentation. I kind of have a comment and a question kind of tied into that, too, with the last day talking about the skull found in Mexico. When I was a little girl, I had a wonderful Native American history book, Meet the North American Indians, and I distinctly remember there was a chapter in there about the Penobscot, and I think they're up in Maine or Canada, and they talked about their practice of headboarding their children so they can get the elongated skulls. And I have never read anything since then about the Penobscot or any other Native American tribe doing headboarding. That seems to have completely disappeared from children's books, I guess, unless somebody can say differently. And I just also wondered if you've done any investigation into the Blith intaglio, which shows the kind of that giant human figure. And I wonder if there has been any elongated skulls found in Southern California or the Mojave, because this seems just like a North American-wide phenomenon as well as the rest of the world.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I do think that the Native Americans down in California, they did modify their craniums. This, you know, this practice was so widespread on the West Coast of the Americas, period, that, if you know the Condelabra of the Andes, I'm sure most people here are aware of that. That's like about 5 miles from the Paracas Graves, and it's visible 12 miles out to sea. So when you look at their relatives right up the coastline, probably hop down there with boats, and this is, hey, man, we don't have a lighthouse, but this tells you to just park your boats here to trade with us. So it seems to me like, again, the stuff in California gets really weird because I honestly think a lot of the things that were found over the time has been, you read the reports and they're, when this part of the country wasn't very settled at all, they could, hey man, I found these giant bones, I'm on my way back to the Smithsonian with them, oh, they didn't make it. That's because some rich dude sent an envoy to buy them from me halfway back, right? This is, again, I get real cynical or skeptical about, I get cynical about people being assholes, I can always say, right? And as far as the head binding and how that was, it's kind of just being erased from the books and stuff. I remember seeing, my grandpa took me to some forts on the coast, and I remember seeing pictures of Native American in the headboard and stuff. And it wasn't until my friend Sean Mooney, who's a dude from Longview, who's clued me into this, and he started telling me, hey man, there's some of this stuff going on around there I remembered seeing some of these things and talking about it, but it just, you know, it's cool, some of the Indians flatten their heads, great. But then you start looking into it, and it's like, again, you don't even see a picture of Con Conley with that. You go, any of you in here, Google Con Conley skull and see what you find, because it ain't going to be that damn picture that I just showed you from the Smithsonian book. And again, they'll say that this is cultural sensitivity. Go ask the Chinook if they care if you see a picture of that skull or not. They've got that skull repatriated, and they've got it safe. And most tribes, in my experience, living up in the Pacific Northwest, and anybody can correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me that the more successful a tribe is, the more pragmatic they are when dealing with the white man. They're just like, you know, like Dighton Rock, I just mentioned earlier. The Native Americans went ahead and coughed it up to the people that are, I forget what country it's from, Portugal. The Portuguese population there tried to claim it, and the Native American tribes that had the real claim to it said, you know what, go ahead. Would you guys vote to let us have a casino on this land? Okay, cool. Shake hands. And so, yeah, and there, I mean, which one matters more? In an ideal world, you could have both, but if you have to choose between your legacy or making a better world for your kids, only a dumbass picks their legacy, right? So it's unfortunate. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Dan.
Thank you.
Hello, hello.
Yeah.
Hi,
what's your name? How are you doing, Luciano? Well,
thank you for that great presentation.
Thank you.
I think it was super insightful and entertaining. And is it possible to put the map?
Could you cue the map back up, please, guys?
Thank you so much. I was going to ask you because I have the lucky chance to just recently come from Easter Island, and I just realized that most of the Pacific Shore, you know, findings of these ancient skulls is actually facing Easter Island. And I was just wondering while sitting and listening to your presentation, isn't Easter Island kind of like ground zero for skull elongation and skull deformation? Because when you see the moais, and especially the ones that are close to Ranuraraku, which is a volcano, they have these incredibly long pointed heads, right? Sometimes, you know, and it's like, we don't know what's the origin of those moais, no? So yeah. Maybe there's a connection there.
That's quite, you know, there was actually research to that under the assumption. Easter Island's one of my favorite places to look into. Like it's got a navel of the, it's the only navel of the world that's way in a far-flung corner of any empire.
Yeah.
This is the Polynesian world. You know, any other navel of the world is like Delhi or the Wailing Wall. It's like right in the middle of their damn culture, yeah. Sacsayhuaman, but not this one. But so I think that that's a leftover from another time. But the skulls that we know of from Rapa Nui don't have elongated. They're not elongated, but they do something else that's really, really interesting. They carved these skulls after the people deceased. They would carve or do artwork on them, and the images quite frequently resemble the candelabra of the Andes, frequently.
Yeah.
And the Easter Island is, it was brutally looted by slavers. So they wrote down almost nothing of what they did, and given that the time that it was being looted was during the mad dash for the skulls really got hot and heavy when, if you are aware of the now debunked science of phrenology, of measuring people's heads, and this determines the traits and their how smart they are and all this stuff. That kicked off this mad dash for the skulls, and when they were doing the slave raid, the big slave raid on Rapa Nui, it was at a perfect time for them to just any skulls that they could have grabbed and sold. And like I showed you there, once there was no provenance, they just call them Indian chief, right? There's a chief, if so, we don't know which one, but it's a chief. Yeah. It gets more money. I definitely think Easter Island was involved, but it's unfortunate that the history of that place is so just hammered.
Yeah, it's an incognito. You know, it's something, it's a, something that has to be discovered. Well, thank you very much.
Gil, thank you. It's good to talk to you again.
Wow, I'm in the limelight here. I live just in Flagstaff, and I just opened my backyard gate, and then there's a pile of pottery, and just to the other side, there's a Hopi village where the Anasazi lived, and I'm surrounded by all that stuff. So the pottery just intrigued me to the whys and the what. Why do we have this all this broken pottery and this and that? So I put in the name of the crater. There's O'Neill's Crater, which is next to my house, and I get this 32-page Smithsonian article written in the 1930s that the Smithsonian people went all around these sites. There's nine of them. There's Walnut Canyon, Wapaki. It's just this horrible thought in my head. But saying they just took the pottery and just stored it, and there's just a few things, nothing else. And I'm thinking, no, they didn't. They were looking for giants. And So this village, so the Hopi people call them the Anasazi. Then we have the Anunnaki. But the Hopi people call the Anasazi the Holy Ones. And so the reason I'm bringing this up is I spoke to Derek last night, and I just wanted to get your opinion on the thoughts of this. He says that the giants killed all the Anasazi, and that that's why we can't find any bones from the Anasazi. We have no grave sites from them. Now, with the tribe, so with Navajo and Hopi, they say they were taken. They left the planet. The Anunnaki, we get the same ANU that they, I guess they helped teach people how to grow crops. I don't know what the Anasazi did for people, but I'm assuming that's what it is. So I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts with that. Have you heard of the giants getting rid of these entire
people? I've heard, yeah. A lot of times I'm not sure if the race of giants wasn't just part of, part of the culture at that point, where it was just, some tribes were that way and some tribes weren't. You know, the same as, some races of people look different than others today. I mean, it's really frustrating to me because I know that I don't know. I know that they took all the silver quarters already, so I can't tell you anything about it. And that really frustrates the hell out of me because I'm really slow to, if you've ever watched my videos, I probably am the most frustrating guy to watch at the end of a video because I'll always be like, well, we need more research, boys. Sorry, I don't want to tell you. But that's, so a lot of times you'll get a person like me, I feel like I need to make sure and say this, a person like me who's more skeptical and slow to make those kinds of connections and slow to accept them, I don't look down on people like Derek who are like, I think this is what happened. It's actually, we need people like Derek to say, I think this is what happened. And we also need somebody like me to not be an asshole about it, but to come kick the tires a bit and go, well, are you sure about that? And that's where the lack of evidence just makes me wring my hands in fury because I can't do it. He can do his thing, but I can't do mine, if that makes sense.
So you're saying there's a lack of evidence? Just how I'm feeling about it, but the bastards took the giants out of those ruins, and I just can't believe what they did in the 1930s.
Yes, if you know who Ailes Hydrilica is, he was an archaeologist for the Smithsonian Institution in the 30s. It even says it on Wikipedia, which is notoriously edited by archaeologists, but. On this page, it's about the Folsom culture, which is, for those of you who collect arrowheads, the Folsom Point, it's after the Clovis Points. Ailes Hydrilica is well known for blocking any inquiry. If you wanted to have a serious career as an archaeologist, you could not look into deep time origins of the humanity on the Americas beyond 3,000 years. And he is the guy, when you look at he's the guy that did all the... Yeah, that's not really a giant. This guy didn't know how to use a tape measure. It's one dude, and he was actually given, I forget the name of the award, but there's some big archaeology award. He was given an award, and one of the things that they cited was for his vigorous opposition to pseudo-archaeology, or what pseudoscience or whatever. It's just like, my dear God. But so, yeah, they've been doing this since long before I was born.
Wait, do you think it's before the 1930s?
Oh, do I think...
The Smithsonian?
Oh, I think the Smithsonian's been doing that stuff for as long... You know, Abraham Lincoln talked about the giants in the mounds, right? And I think that, 20, 30 years later, they were starting to hush that stuff up. And then, by the 30s... I spoke about NAGPRA a minute ago, right? And, there is one organization in the country that's immune to NAGPRA that they don't have to give Indians back their bones. And that's the Smithsonian.
Yeah,
you can Google that too and look it up. Even the internet will tell you that one.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This might be a quick one. I recently watched Jesse Michael's podcast, American Alchemist, on the tridactyls. Have you looked into that? They did CAT scans on these three-fingered, three-toed mummies.
I've looked into it a little bit. Thank you for asking. It's definitely definitely part of this whole thing. And this is where I think having empathy for and some understanding for another country, says the guy who's never been there. Zahi Hawass, to me, infamously said that, talking about Arab Spring and about how to make the most money for your country, and he says that doesn't matter what's happening in Egypt, those New Age people, they come. And when you look at it from that perspective, it's like he also talks about you don't always want quantity of tourists, you want quality. We want the Americans, we want the Japanese, we want the Chinese, we want the people with bucks in their pocket. And it makes sense. I mean, from a poor country's perspective. And so when you look at a place like Peru that we've already had, you know, it's unfortunate because Peru isn't poor everywhere, but in places just like Egypt, it's got a lot of problems with poverty. And so, you know, the tunnels under Sacsayhuaman or at Cusco that they just discovered, right? There's a scientist that was talking about those 20 years ago, Brian Forster, to take you a tour on them 10 years ago for $5 and a bag of rice. You get a tour of them from 1550 years ago. It's been, they were recorded by Garcilaso de la Vega, the half Spanish, half Inca guy that's got some of the best records we have of those times. And they just now found them. And again, I'm not skeptical. I'm downright cynical when it comes to humans being assholes. I think they gutted those tunnels, man. They got every skull, they got every rock, they got every stitch of gold, every artifact, and now it's like, okay, open these things up to the tourists. We found them, boys. So to go back to the tridactyl mummies, it's like, these need to just be put out for many scientists to put their fingers on. As it is right now, I'm really skeptical. It's one of those things where if it's generating more revenue than it is data, I start to get a little, especially in a poor country. So I'm interested in them and I want to know more, but I am getting the lack of independently confirmed data and the amount of money that it just keeps making kind of makes it. Let's put it this way. If I tell you this is magic water and I'm going to evaluate it next week, I'm going to evaluate it next week. Well, actually, it's going to probably be the week after that. Just keep donating money to my Patreon, and I'm just going to kick that ball down the curb as long as it takes, because the second we evaluate it, the goose that laid the golden egg just died. So I worry about that a lot, and so I'm very skeptical of those until we got more data. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Check 1, 2.
Should probably get that in my pocket, huh?
Yeah, no worries. Well, Dan, thank you so much for that presentation. It was really enlightening, educational. In case I don't get to corner you this weekend, I do want to ask you a question that we didn't cover in your presentation. Something that the audience may be aware of is in Montana, the Montana megaliths. And I believe you visited there. And I've seen video of this place, I've seen pictures of it. Some of it looks very interesting, and then some of it looks like it could have been done by natural causes. Could you tell everybody, just kind of real quickly, what is the Montana megaliths, and what is your opinion on some of the structures there, particularly the Sage Wall?
Yep, absolutely. Yes, I was very fortunate to have been invited to Sage Wall by the owner of the property, who's such a cool dude that he don't even want you talking about his name and stuff. He's just like, I don't want to be associated. It's not my place, just the Sage Wall. He's really cool. The area is amazing. It's the wall itself looks so man-made until you look at the area in general. And you can stand at one point at it and look at the wall just going straight, and you can see where that vein of granite goes underground, and then you can see it twist underground and go off down the hill a bit. And the area, you can stand from the wall, you can look down a cliff and see other things like that, but they're all windy where the wall is very straight. And then you look at the straight cleaves in the rock, and it's literally everywhere in that area. I guess maybe it's the crystalline structure, the amount of quartz that's in that granite, because it is really high quartz content, but it's everywhere you look, you see similar things. A lot of places, it's very clearly natural. So on the flip side, it's extremely intriguing. The Native Americans definitely were honoring some of these places. And then I don't know if any of you, have you ever seen Tizer Dolmen?
Is that one of the big dolmens there?
Yes, the big
one. I've seen the really tall one, yeah. Just pictures of it.
Well, that one, if you stand on the one side, it's really tall. It's, you know, tall as that from us to that screen. But in the front of it, the area is kind of scooped out where it looks like, you know, they could have stood this thing up in there. And if you go to the back side of it, there's actually a hill that goes up. You could, a family of four could make a dirt ramp that pushed that top part up in a day, and then get rid of the, and then you've got a pretty nice place. I showed you the canoe burials earlier. This is how you keep stuff away from the wolves, man. When I look at Tizer Dolmen, their explanation is, the mainstream explanation is that the granite formed, and then it was covered, and then it broke, and then under slowly erosion, and it just left it that way. And I'll buy that on a lot of these dolmens that aren't, No, that one's way more obviously man-made. And there's a few areas in that. And there's even three indentations on top, like the kind of thing where you'd maybe store something liquid or put a grain in so it didn't blow off. It's, to me, that Tizer Dolmen is pretty clearly man-made or artificially modified, you could say.
Thank you so much for that. And real quick, on the sage wall, is that clearly man-made, or could you see a geological process to where that could have been done naturally?
Did I say man-made? Because I meant...
No, you didn't, but I just want to make sure
sorry.
That's clear.
No, I meant that it's clearly geological, that it is, it looks man-made, but it's, when you're standing on it, you look down, you can see that it's, sorry for misspeaking there, you can see that the vein of rock goes straight and then curves and winds. The rock all over the region cleaves the same way, so it seems like a lot of these things, like the sage wall itself, in my mind, looks very... It looks really intriguing, but it seems very natural. But there's areas there that do look modified, like the Tizer Dolmen. Sorry about.
No, thank you so much for that clarification, Dan. This is amazing. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you.
I'm going to corner you to ask more questions.
So we've got about a 15-minute bathroom break, and then we're going to get set up for Barco Roman. So we got 11:30. We'll be back here, and Mark will be ready to go.